Let's turn to Numbers chapter 15. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have come into the land that you are to inhabit, which I am giving to you." Now, this to me is really special. In that, they have just been turned away from the land. They've just been told that they're going to have to wait for 40 years. Their unbelief in God has denied them access into the promised land. And so, it is a time when they said, well, you know, we'll do it. We'll go in. We made a mistake. We're sorry. And Moses said, no, God won't be with you. And the enemies came out and they were defeated. So they've just been defeated by the inhabitants of the land. They've just been turned away. They've just been consigned by God to 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And it is at this time that God then gives to them the commands of the type of offering that they are to offer when they come into the land. It is sort of God reassuring them that they are going to come into the land. It would be a time of tremendous discouragement, especially if you were, you know, in that age bracket that you know that the 40 years is going to get you. And you know that the rest of your life you're going to be roaming in this wilderness. You're not going to be able to get out of this wilderness. It's not a pleasant, happy place to live. And now you've got the rest of your life looking forward to this existence in the wilderness. You're not going to make it into the land. And it would be a time of tremendous depression and discouragement. And so God gives to them commandments at this time that have to do when they come into the land. So God is assuring them, you are going to come into the land. It's going to be a time, this generation is going to die off, but when you come into the land that you're going to inhabit, that I am going to give to you. And so he tells them then about the types of offerings that they are to offer to him at the time that they come in to the land. And that takes us through verse 21, the heave offerings and so forth. And it doesn't relate to us, and so we're going to just pass over it. In verse 22, God then gives the command concerning the offerings for their unintentional sins. So often sin is unintentional, and yet it must be atoned for. Like they say, ignorance of the law is no excuse. And if you are unintentional in your violation, still it is a violation. And so there were sacrifices and offerings that had to be made for unintentional sins. For a person who sinned presumptuously, that's something different. Verse 30. If a person does something presumptuously, whether he's a native born or stranger, that brings a reproach on the Lord, he will be cut off from his people because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment. That person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be upon him, the presumptuous sin. Having then given that law for the presumptuous sin, we immediately have an example of a man who was guilty of presumptuous sin. So while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man who was gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. A presumptuous sin. They were told the Sabbath day was to be holy unto the Lord. They weren't to do any type of labor. This man knew the law. His gathering sticks on the Sabbath day was a presumptuous sin. And so they brought him to Moses and Aaron. and to all the congregation. And so they put him under the guard because it had not been explained exactly what should be done to him. It was told that he should be put to death, but they didn't know how he was to be executed. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man must surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside of the camp." So as the Lord commanded Moses, all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones, and he died. So the severe consequences upon the person who sinned presumptuously. Then in verse 37, the Lord spoke to Moses concerning their garments, that they were to make these little tassels on the corners of their garments throughout their generations. And there was to be this blue thread, sky blue thread, in the tassel. "And you shall have the tassel that you may look upon it and remember all of the commandments of the Lord to do them, that you may not follow the harlotry to which your own heart and your own eyes are inclined." So on their outer garment, the four corners of this outer garment, they sewed these little tassels with the blue thread in them. And every time they put on this, the blue thread would remind them of the law of the Lord, how I am to follow after the Lord, the reminder. Now, Jesus, in obedience to the law, had on his robe the tassels on the corners of his robe. And you read in the scripture how that he was on his way to Jairus' house at the death of Jairus' daughter, when a woman made her way through the crowd and grabbed, it said, the hem of his garment. It says, touch the hem of his garment. In the Greek, it declares that she snatched or she grasped hold of the tassel. So this tassel on Jesus' garment is what the woman grabbed hold of. For she was hemorrhaging, had been hemorrhaging for 12 years. And she had said in her heart, I know if I could just grab hold of his garment, tassel in his garment, I would be healed. And the moment she grabbed hold of the tassel on his garment, the hemorrhaging ceased. And so this was what is commanded here in Numbers. God knows our tendency to forget things. God, well, as he said, that we not follow after the harlotry which is in our heart and in our own eyes, to which we are inclined. We're inclined to follow after our own desires, our own wishes. God wants us to follow after his law. And so we need to be reminded. And so even on their garments, these tassels with the blue threads were reminders that I am to seek the law of the Lord, to fulfill and to keep the law of the Lord. And of course, interesting to me that Jesus wore the garment with the tassels on it. And notice it's to be throughout all their generations. So today they wear the talith, but they don't wear it as an outer garment anymore. And it has the little tassels on it still. So they are to remind you to do all my commandments and be holy for your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God. Now in chapter 16, we get to the rebellion of this fellow Korah. Korah was of the tribe of Kohath, the Kohathites, who lived on the south portion of the tabernacle, adjacent to the tabernacle. And Korah, had no doubt stirred up problems with the other people, even into the tribe of Reuben, which was camped next to the tribe of Levi. And some of the sons of Eliab, Dathan, and Abiram, and on of the tribes of Reuben. They gathered together a bunch of men, sort of in a conspiracy against Moses. They were upset because they said Moses takes too much upon himself in that he has set up Aaron to offer the sacrifices before the Lord, and others of the tribe of Levi, the Kohathites, they have as much right to offer sacrifices as does Moses. In fact, all of us are the people of God. So all of us have the rights to offer sacrifices. The whole congregation is holy to the Lord. So any of us, you know, can stand before the Lord. And this was the conspiracy that and the complaint that Korah had. I personally believe that there is probably some envy and jealousy involved as Korah saw the glorious robe of the high priest as worn by Aaron, saw the glory of the office, the way the people would look upon him with awe, and he desired himself to have this glory. And so he began to create this rumble, this insurrection. And it's amazing how that a person can often create division within the body over little issues. But it begins to grow, it begins to develop until everybody is stirred up over the thing. And such a stir was created by Korah. And so finally, they got up enough nerve to come to Moses. Verse 3, they gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and they said to them, "You take too much on yourselves, for all of the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the congregation of the Lord?" So when Moses heard it, he fell on his face. And this is a, you know, poor Moses always falling on his face because they were always finding something to complain about. And so he spoke to Korah and all of his company, and he said, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his and who is holy. And he will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. Do this. Take censers, Korah, and all of your company. Put fire in them and put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow. And it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the Holy One. And you take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi." So here they are making their complaint. "We have a right to do it as much as you. You've taken too much upon yourself. And, you know, we are holy. We're part of God's people. We have the right to do it." Moses, "All right, we'll accept the challenge. Tomorrow you get your censers and you come and stand here before the Lord." Then Moses said to Korah, "And hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord, to stand before the congregation, to serve them?" God has called you to this task of serving his people. You've been called to be a minister, to work here in the tabernacle. Doesn't that mean something to you? Can't you be satisfied and thrilled that God has called you to serve his people? "He has brought you near to himself. You are the closest to the tabernacle, you and your brethren, the sons of Levi. Are you now also aspiring for the priesthood?" There are places in the body of Christ that seem to have a certain amount of attraction because it places you before people in your ministry. And there are those who are attracted to the ministry for wrong reasons. Not because God has called them, but there is within their heart a desire to be recognized, to be noticed. And sad but true, there are many people in the ministry today to fulfill a personal psychological need. They're not really fit for the ministry. As we read in Hebrews concerning the priesthood, and this is where it comes from in this chapter, where it declares, no man takes this office unto himself. In other words, you just don't choose yourself, well, that's what I'm going to do, that's what I'm going to be. It's not like a little boy saying, well, I grow up, I'm going to be a fireman. When I grow up, I'm going to be a preacher. No, that's something that you must be called of God. And it isn't something that you choose for yourself. We do sometimes find those who have made the choice for themselves. There's an allurement, an attraction, and they've been drawn to that to fulfill a need in their own life and not there because of the call of God. But I'll tell you what. I think that the hardest thing in the world is to try to be something God didn't make you. I think that it's the most frustrating thing in the world to try to do the work of God in the energy of the flesh or in the abilities of the flesh. Even within the ministry, there are various callings. First apostles, then prophets, then evangelists, then pastor teachers for the perfecting of the saints. And if God hasn't called you to be an evangelist, it's awfully tough trying to be an evangelist. If God hasn't called you to be a pastor teacher, it's awfully tough trying to be a pastor teacher. I speak by experience. Because I sought to be an evangelist for years. In the early years of my ministry, I sought to be an evangelist. God called me as a pastor teacher. I wanted to be an evangelist. I was a total failure as an evangelist. Total failure. God didn't call me to be an evangelist. Yet I tried my best to be an evangelist. Kay tried to help me. She saw my struggle. She said, honey, you're not dynamic. Watch Billy Graham. He doesn't just stand behind the pulpit. He takes the microphone and he walks back and forth. You got to be more dynamic, honey. And so I sought to be dynamic. I had a powerful point in this Sunday morning message, and I decided to really put it across in a dynamic way. And so I took the mic, a la Billy Graham, walked over to the edge of the platform, got my hand in the Billy Graham's, you know, position to really drive the point home, and I forgot the point. My mind went totally blank. Do you know how foolish you feel standing over at the edge of the platform, your finger up in the air like this, the mic in your hand, and you can't think of anything to say? I stood there for a moment just thinking how foolish I must look, and then walked back and got my notes and found out the point I was going to bring. And that was my last endeavor to be dynamic. But trying to be an evangelist when God didn't call me to be an evangelist was extremely difficult. Well, it was I just didn't make it. I just couldn't make it. And the ministry is something that God calls you to do, but God not only calls you, but He enables you. And as a pastor teacher, I'm extremely comfortable. I love it. People talk about burnout and stuff like that, and I don't know what they're talking about. I love it. I could go 7 days a week. I enjoy it. Because God has called me and anointed me as a pastor teacher. But to try to go into an area where God hasn't called, dangerous. As Korah found out, no man takes this upon himself. You don't just say, well, that's what I'm going to do or that's what I'm going to be. It is a calling of God. So Moses said to him, look, God's called you. You're serving the people of God. Now, you're trying to promote yourself to the priesthood. Therefore, you and all of your company are gathered together against the Lord. You haven't gathered against Aaron and myself. You've gathered really against the Lord. Because that's where God placed you, and you're not satisfied where God has placed you in the ministry, in the service to Him. You're striving for something else. And thus you're striving against the Lord. And what is Aaron that you murmur against him? I mean, God placed him there. So Moses said, tell Dathan and Abiram to come on over here. And they sent back and they said, we're not coming. Open rebellion now. And then they made some very negative and nasty remarks against Moses. They said, is it a small thing that you've brought us up out of a land that was flowing with milk and honey? Now that was the promise. God said, I'm going to bring you into a land. And they said, hey, you brought us out of a land that was flowing with milk and honey. And you brought us out here to kill us in the wilderness. And now you keep acting like a prince over us, you know. Moreover, you've not brought us into the land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us the inheritance of fields and vineyards. And now will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. You're going to try and put the wool over these guys' eyes? We're not coming up. You know, you brought us out of the land. You brought us out here to die in the wilderness. You didn't keep your word. You didn't bring us into the land. Now you're going to try and pull the wool over these guys' eyes. Hey, not us, man. We're not coming up. So Moses was very angry, and he said to the Lord, do not respect their offering, because I haven't taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them. They're making these vicious charges against Moses, and Moses said, Lord, you know, I'm innocent. I haven't taken anything from them. And Moses said to Korah, tomorrow you and all of your company be present before the Lord, you and they, as well as Aaron. And each of you take your censer, put incense in it, and each of you bring his censer before the Lord. 250 censers, you also and Aaron, each one of you with his censer. So every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid the incense on it, and they stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Korah had really stirred up a big group of people standing there now at the door of the tabernacle. Then the glory, the Shekinah of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, now separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. Stand back from them, Moses and Aaron, I'll wipe them out. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, and then they fell on their faces again and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, Shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation? So they were laying really the full blame right back on Korah, who started the whole insurrection. Notice he is called the God of the spirits of all flesh. God formed man out of the dust of the earth, that is his body. And then God breathed into his nostrils and he became a living soul. But man basically is a spirit. The body isn't the real me. We associate the person with their body, but the body is not the real me. This body is only a tent that I'm living in for a while. The real me is spirit. God is the Father of the spirits of all men. Man basically is a spirit. He dwells in a body. He possesses a consciousness or a soul. But man basically is spirit, living in a body, possessing a consciousness. Now, it is possible to live in a body possessing a consciousness, your spirit being dead. For the Bible speaks of a person who lives after the flesh is dead while he's still alive. If you live on a body conscious plane, you're living on the animal plane. Animals do not possess a spirit. Man possesses a spirit, separates us from the animal kingdom. Don't let any evolutionist tell you that you're just a highly evolved animal. Not so. You're a fallen creature. You were made in the image of God in the beginning, and we have fallen from that image. Man is separated by a wide gap from the animal kingdom in that God has given to us the spirit, the capacity to understand infinity exists. We don't understand infinity, but we can think abstractly and we can conceive of infinity. We can conceive of God. We can worship God. We're separated by a long ways, but we are fallen from God, from the image of God, from the likeness of God in which man was first created. It is the purpose of God to restore you into that image. For that purpose, he sent his Son to die for your sins. For that purpose, he has sent the Holy Spirit to conform us into the image of Jesus Christ. Now, that doesn't make me Jesus Christ. And this God-man concept is a heresy. But I've been made into the image of Christ, or I am being made by the work of the Spirit. He's got a long way to go, but he's working on it. So, the God of the spirits of all flesh. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation and say, get away from the tents of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. So Moses went up to the tent of Dathan and Abiram, there in Reuben, tribe of Reuben. And the elders of Israel followed him, and he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Don't touch anything of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. So they got away. They made some space from around the tents of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood in the door of their tents with their wives and their sons and their little children. Then Moses said, by this you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. Hey, I am an imposter. I'm here on my own. If these fellows die a natural death just like anybody else. But if the Lord creates a new thing and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up and all that belongs to them and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord. Then it came to pass, just as soon as he was finished speaking these words, that the ground split apart right under them. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households and all of the men with Korah and all of their goods. So they and all of those that were with them went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the congregation. Quite an exciting experience, I'm sure, for those standing by. Frightening experience. And all Israel who were around them fled at their cry. I mean, they probably were shrieking as the thing opened up, and they began to shriek, and they fled from their cry, for they said, lest the earth swallow us up also. Hey, we were joining ourselves with Korah. We better get out of here. Earth's apt to do the same thing for us. People have problems that the families were involved with them, even their little children. There are ways to rationalize it, but why? I don't have to explain God or why God does what he does. And if I put myself in the position of defending God, then I'm sort of in a peculiar position, aren't I? That God should need my defense. God has his reasons for doing what he does. And really, I don't feel qualified to challenge the reasons of God because I don't have all the facts. Now, I don't say that I understand why God would do that. If I were God, I'd probably say, take these little kids and some of you others adopt them, you know. And spare the little children, but let the old man go down. But I'm not God. And I could have botched things up pretty thoroughly had I been God. Because some of the things that I thought were so smart and so wise turned out not to be so smart or wise. And thus, it used to be that I sought to defend God. I tried to give an explanation why this, you know, could possibly be and so forth. The Lord so spoke to my heart and said, hey, I don't need you to defend me. And so I quit. I just let him be God. And also, I quit asking for explanations. God can do what he wants. He doesn't owe me an explanation at all. You know, why, God, did you allow that? Lord, why did you do this? You know, and I'm always asking for explanations. Used to be. I don't anymore. God can do what he wants. And what he does is the best. It's the wisest. It's his intelligence is in a level that is so far to superior to mine that it's really foolish for me to challenge God or to question God. Best that I learned to just commit it to God. Say, well, Lord, don't know what you're doing. I'm really confused, but I trust you. And I'm just trusting in you. You know what's best, and so you do what's best, Lord. And that's the place of faith. That's the place of faith. Habakkuk was brought to that place of faith. He was complaining to the Lord. He said, Lord, it's all going to pieces, and you're not doing anything about it. Please, Lord, do me a favor. I don't want to know anything else. You know, I'm not going to watch TV anymore. I'm not going to watch the news. I'm not going to watch anything. I don't want to know what's going on. Because it's too frustrating to see these corrupt things happening when you're not doing anything about it. And that is always frustrating, to have these things happening and be totally powerless to do anything, and it doesn't seem like God's doing anything. God said, Habakkuk, I am doing a work. If I told you what I was doing, you wouldn't believe it. Habakkuk said, what are you doing? God said, well, I'm bringing the Babylonian army, and they're going to punish these people for me. They're going to wipe them out, destroy them. And Habakkuk said, Lord, That's not fair. We're bad, true, but they're worse than we are. Why would you use a nation that's more sinful to punish a godly people? Oh, his tune changed. God said, I told you you wouldn't believe it. So Habakkuk said, I'm going to get into my tower, and I'm just going to wait and see what you're going to do. I'm just going to wait and watch and sit up there in the tower and watch. While he was in the tower, the word of the Lord came to Habakkuk and said, Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith. It's a life of faith. It's a walk of faith. So in the next chapter, chapter 3, Habakkuk prayed again and he said, Lord, I cried to you out of the reason of my distress. And you told me that you were working. And I don't understand what you're doing, but Lord, keep doing it. I don't understand. But revive thy work, and in the midst of the years, remember mercy. Revive thy work is literally keep alive your work. Keep doing it, Lord, but don't forget to be merciful. Remember mercy. Now, that's a position of faith. God, I don't understand what you're doing, but keep doing it. Keep alive your work. Keep working, Lord. Though I don't understand, don't stop. That takes faith. You see, my understanding is being challenged. I don't know what God is doing, but I'm satisfied to just let God continue to do it. Let God be God. In Romans, the first chapter, we are told concerning the wrath of God that's going to be revealed against the ungodly and the unrighteous. And those that hold the truth of God in unrighteousness. For when they knew God, they did not glorify him as God. How is that possible? By my challenging him every time he does something. That's not glorifying him as God. By saying, why God would you allow that? Why God would you do that? That's not glorifying him as God. That's really, in a sense, exalting my own knowledge and wisdom and understanding above his, saying, Lord, if I were you, I surely wouldn't have made that blooper. You really blew it that time, God. I'm shocked. Let God be God. Mine is just to say, well, Lord, you're God. You work. You know what's best. I just submit to you. A fire came out from the Lord, verse 35, and consumed the 250 men who were standing there with their little incense offerings. So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell Eleazar, who was the elder son of Aaron, to pick up the censers out of the blaze. The fire came out and just these guys were burning. They were emulated on the spot. Take those brass censers out of the blaze, for they are holy. Scatter the fire that is in them some distance away, and the censers of these men who sinned against their own souls, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, because they presented them before the Lord, therefore they are holy. Anything that was given to the Lord remained the Lord's. It was holy. You weren't to use it for something else. They've used these brass censers. They presented them to the Lord, so they're holy. So take them, but beat them into plates, brass plate, and cover the altar with this hammered plates, to be a reminder to the children of Israel that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should come near to offer incense before the Lord, that he might not become like Korah and his companions, just as the Lord had said to him through Moses. So the altar then was covered by this brass plate, hammered brass, that was made from these 250 little brass censers that these guys have brought, the little incense bowls, They hammered it into a plate, covered the altar, so that any time a person looked at the altar of sacrifice, seeing the brass plates, they know, hey, it belongs to Aaron and his family, and you know, don't tread on that ground. That is a place that no man puts himself in the position of the priest. That comes by the birthright through Aaron. No outsider. No man takes this office unto himself. On the next day, all of the congregation of the children of Israel, you'd think repented, but instead they murmured against Moses and Aaron. And look at this accusation. You've killed the people of the Lord. Oh, man. I don't know how you deal with people like this. Now it happened when the congregation had gathered against Moses and Aaron that they turned toward the tabernacle of meeting, and suddenly the cloud covered it, this cloud of God's presence, and the glory, the Shekinah of the Lord appeared. And Moses and Aaron came before the tabernacle of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, get away from among this congregation that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell on their faces. So the third time in a couple of days they're on their faces. So Moses said to Aaron, take a censer and put fire in it from the altar and put incense on it and take it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun. And then Aaron took, as Moses commanded, ran into the midst of the congregation, and already the plague had begun among the people. So he put the incense and made atonement for the people, and he stood between the living and the dead. So the plague was stopped. And what a picture. The plague had already begun. Already 14,700 have been killed by the plague as God was beginning to wipe the people out. And here is Aaron standing there now. These dead bodies on the one side and the congregation still alive on the other. And he's there swinging his incense. And the incense is a symbol of prayer in the scriptures. And the prayers rise with the incense. And they offered before the Lord their golden vials full of odors, which are the prayers of the saints, Revelation 5. And so the intercessory prayers standing between the living and the dead. And our place as intercessors in prayer, really standing between the living and the dead. I believe that our nation, the plague has already begun. I believe that the plague has already started to wipe people out. And we, as the priest of God in this generation, are to pray and to stand between the living and the dead. We need to pray and intercede for our nation, for our community, for our neighbors, for our children in some cases. So Aaron returned to Moses at the door of the tabernacle of meeting because the plague had stopped. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and get from them a rod from each father's house. All of their leaders, according to their father's houses, 12 rods. And then write each man's name on his rod. So they gathered the rods from the 12 tribes and then also Aaron's rod beside. And you shall write Aaron's name on the rod of Levi, for there shall be one rod for the head of each father's house. And you're to place them in the tabernacle of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And it shall be that the rod of the man whom I choose will blossom, and thus I will rid myself of the murmurings of the children of Israel, which they murmur against you. We'll settle it now. Have each tribe bring a rod and write the name of each tribe upon the rod, the head of that tribe. On the tribe of Levi, write Aaron. And so Moses spoke to the children of Israel. Each of the leaders gave him a rod. For each leader, according to their father's houses, 12 rods, and the rod of Aaron was among their rods. And Moses placed the rods before the Lord in the tabernacle of witness. Now it came to pass on the next day that Moses went into the tabernacle of witness, and behold, the rod of Aaron, the house of Levi, had sprouted, put forth buds, had produced blossoms, and yielded ripe almonds. And so it went the whole route. There were buds and ripe almonds and sprouts on the thing. And so Moses brought out all the rods from before the Lord to the children of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his rod. And the Lord said to Moses, "Now bring Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels, that you may put their murmurings away from me, lest they die." And thus Moses did as the Lord commanded. So, in the Ark of the Covenant, there in the Holy of Holies, there was then placed the rod of Aaron, the two tables of stone upon which the law was written, and a jar of manna, the food that God provided for them in the wilderness. It would surely be one of the most exciting archaeological discoveries ever if they could discover the Ark of the Covenant. To see the rod of Aaron, two tables of stone, my, that would be something fantastic. But God, in his purposes, has decided to keep it. Well, it's probably good. Because, you know, there would be such a fight among the churches and between the Jews of who should have the rights, you know, to display this thing. And don't you know it would be commercialized to the hilt? You know, outside there'd be all these hawkers that are selling you little tables of stones and little sticks, and they'll declare that this stick, you know, came from the same almond tree or whatever that he originally got his rod from. And so it's probably best. They would make it actually they would worship it. They would make it a shrine to worship. So God in his wisdom has lost the thing as far as man is concerned. Now, in chapter 18, we get to the duties of the priest as the Lord now is speaking to Aaron concerning their ministry, the sons, and their remuneration for their ministry. And he tells them that they are to take care of the needs within the tabernacle, that the others are there to help them with the physical aspects, but they are to handle the priesthood. And it was given to them as a gift for service, but the outsider who would come near would be put to death. Verse 8, and the Lord spoke to Aaron. Here he said, "I myself have also given you the charge of my heave offerings, the holy gifts. I've given them a portion to you and your sons as an ordinance forever." So the heave offerings that were brought in, they then went to Aaron and his family. They became their inheritance. And all of the offerings that were brought in, they were to go to the priesthood. And they became theirs. And the best of the oil, the best of the new wine and the grain, the first fruits which they offer, God said, "I've given them to you." Verse 12, "The ripe fruit that they bring in is yours, and every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours, except for the sacrifices that are brought in, the firstborn of the ox and the sheep and all, they had to be offered to the Lord, the firstborn cow, the sheep, and the goat. They're not to redeem, they're holy. But the others, they could redeem them, the firstborn, and then they belong to them." And God said it is a covenant of salt, verse 19, forever. Now, salt was known as something that was sort of imperishable. It was considered imperishable. And thus the salt of covenant was a common covenant, that means that the covenant shall not perish. And that's the idea behind the salt covenant. It means it's one that won't stop. It goes on. It's imperishable. It's a covenant that will stand. And so God made this a covenant of salt with Aaron. And then the Lord said, the last of verse 20, and I love this, I am your portion and your inheritance among the children of Israel. You're not going to inherit the land. You won't get any land there because I am your inheritance. And then I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they performed, the work for the tabernacle of meeting. So the tithes were to be brought in and were given to support the family or the tribe of Levi who were to do the service of God within the tabernacle, and it was their pay for the service within the tabernacle. But they themselves, interestingly enough, were to tithe. And I thought that that was also interesting. And verse 25, he begins to speak of the tithe of the Levites. They themselves were to tithe. In verse 32, they are not to profane the holy gifts of the children of Israel, lest you die. The priesthood in years to come became corrupted, and they began to profane the gifts that the people brought to the Lord, and there were serious consequences. Now, chapter 19 deals with something that's quite interesting. It was the law of the red heifer. And this has quite a bit of interest today because the ashes of the red heifer were mixed with water and they were used symbolically as a purification. And for a person who was unclean because of the defilement of a dead body or whatever, could not come back into the congregation of the people until he had had this purification water in which the ashes of the red heifer were sprinkled upon him. And it was the waters of purification. And so it deals with how the red heifer was to be slain, and the whole thing was to be burned. Hide and everything else was to be burned by the priest outside of the camp. And then he was unclean. He had to go through the cleansing rites. When he came back into the camp, he could not go into the tabernacle. He was unclean. And then the fellows were to gather the ashes of this red heifer. And they were to keep them. And then they would take the water and they would sprinkle the ashes of the red heifer in the water. And that then became the water of purification. Whenever a person was ceremonially unclean, they would have to go through this purification. And with this water, they also purified the instruments of the tabernacle. Now, according to the traditions that developed, whenever they ran out of ashes, they would always save a few of the ashes of the original sacrifice of the red heifer, and they would sacrifice another red heifer in the same manner, and they would take the few ashes that remained of the previous sacrifice and they mix it up with the new ashes. So you have sort of the perpetual original red heifer as the ashes would be mixed with the new ashes, and every time a new red heifer was sacrificed, the ashes from the old to be carried through for the purification. Now, the Orthodox Jews today envision a tremendous problem in the rebuilding of the temple before they could start sacrifices and all again. The priest would have to be purified. Now, interestingly enough, in one of the yeshivas in the old city, young men are being trained for the priesthood right now. They're being trained in how to offer the sacrifices, and they are definitely preparing to rebuild their temple and to begin sacrifices again. They don't know when yet, but they figure, hey, we've got to be ready, and so they're training these young men in these yeshivas in the old city for the priesthood. But, as the Orthodox point out, they cannot enter into the priesthood without going through the cleansing rites. And to go through the cleansing rites, we have to have the ashes of the red heifer. And so there is an interesting search today for the ashes of the red heifer, so that they can offer a new sacrifice, but they can take the ashes of the last red heifer that was sacrificed and mix it with the new, so it might carry back to the original one sacrificed here in Numbers. Now, there is a fellow, Vendell Jones, out of Texas, who is raising money because he thinks that down near the area of Qumran, he has found a cave, and he is convinced that this cave has a false floor, and underneath of it, he's convinced, are the ashes of the red heifer. And it's a good thing to make money, solicit money for the expeditions. And he's been gathering money from people so he can go in and make this expedition. He wants to buy the kind of equipment that they can go in and really get down in there and find the ashes of the red heifer. I was talking with a scholar, Dr. Kaufman, just this last March when I was in Israel. And Dr. Kaufman, who probably has made one of the most scholarly studies and research and all for this, believes that the ashes of the red heifer are actually in a cistern on the Mount of Olives. This cistern happens to be, and the reason why he believes this is its position from the Temple Mount and all, and he believes that he has, you know, ancient records that show that it was buried over there at the time of the Babylonian captivity. Or rather, later on, because they did purify the thing after the Babylonian captivity, but later on. But anyhow, it's in the cistern that is in now the compound of the Greek Orthodox Church. And the bishop of the Greek Orthodox Church won't let anybody into the cistern to look, but that's where Dr. Kaufman thinks that they are buried. I volunteered to take a midnight sortie and go into the cistern to see if we could find them. But interestingly enough, as old as this is, it has a very modern significance, as they are searching diligently to find the ashes of the red heifer in case when they rebuild the temple, they'll be able to start the sacrifices and all again. But they feel that they can't do that without, first of all, discovering the ashes of the red heifer so that they could make the purification water and purify the sanctuary and the priests and so forth so that they can get things started. So it's something you'll probably hear more and more about. The ashes of the red heifer. This is where it all comes from. So now you've got the background for it. So if you hear of the ashes of the red heifer, the search for it and all, you think, oh yeah, that's back in Numbers 19. Yeah, that's interesting, you know. And you'll be up on that. So that's where that all comes from. And so it goes ahead in the 19th chapter and gives you all of the rules concerning the cleansing of the person through the sprinkling of this water of purification from in which the ashes of the red heifer had been sprinkled. Now, in chapter 20, we find that Miriam died and was buried there in Kadesh, the death of the older sister of Moses. Now, there was no water, verse 2, for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. These guys got the blame for everything. And now, it should be noted that we've passed over almost 40 years of history. We just jumped from the gainsaying of Korah. We've now come towards the end of the wilderness journey. They're just about ready now to start moving towards the promised land. They've been doing their wandering, and now they're going to start moving toward the land. So 40 years almost have transpired at this point. And they've come to the place and there's no water for the congregation. So they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and they spoke saying, if only we had died with our brethren when they died before the Lord. If only we had, you know, died with Korah. Oh, we'd have been better off. We died back there when Korah was killed. Why have you brought us up to the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness that we and our animals should die here? You know, it would have been better to die back there than to die here. Why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It's not a place where we can plant grain or have figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. So Moses and Aaron had been hearing this for about 40 years, and they were pretty tired of it. And they went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces. And the Shekinah of the Lord appeared to them. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take a rod. Take the rod. You and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together and speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. And thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals. So God said, go out before them and speak to the rock and it'll bring forth water. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock. And he said to them, hear now, you rebels. Must we bring water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. And the water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. And then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron. And he said, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. This was the water of contention, strife, Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Lord, and he was hallowed among them. Now, the charge of God against Moses and Aaron is their failure to properly represent God before the people. You see, Moses was God's representative. The people developed their concepts of God from what they saw in Moses. If Moses was angry, they figured God was angry. If Moses was smiling, they figured God was smiling. He represented God to them. Now, the people are thirsty. True, they are complainers, they are murmurers, and they're saying again the wrong things. But there is a legitimate need. If they don't have water, they're going to die. God understands this. But Moses and Aaron are upset. And so when they come before the Lord, their emotions are involved. They're upset with the people. And God said, now take the rod and go out and stand before the people. Speak to the rock and it'll bring forth water. And God is calm and cool. He's not upset. He's not shook. He's not angry with the people. He knows they're thirsty. He knows they need water. But as Moses goes out from the presence of the Lord to represent God to the people, I've just gone in, talked to the Lord. Now I'm coming out as God's representative. And what does he do? He starts yelling at them, calling them names. You bunch of rebels. How long do I have to put up with you? Do I have to strike this rock and give you water? And he hit the thing twice. God said, Moses, Aaron, you didn't represent me before the people. You were angry. You were upset because of their strife, their contentions. And because of your failure to properly represent me, you're not going to be able to lead them into the land. It was a very serious consequence of their sin or their mistake or their error, whatever you want to call it. Moses' lifelong ambition, right on the verge of fulfillment, was snatched away. Sad and tragic, but that's how important it is to God that he is properly represented. And you are God's representative. How are you representing God to the world around you? What kind of a concept do your neighbors have of God as a result of your representation? How do they view God? How do they think of God? Because you're his representative. And people are looking at you to develop their concepts of God. And it is important that we properly represent God. The other issue involved is the smiting of the rock twice. When they had first come into the wilderness, before they had come to Mount Sinai, they were in an area where they were destitute. They needed water. They were thirsty. They came to Moses. God said, Moses, go out and smite the rock with your rod, and water will come forth. And Moses went out and he smote the rock, and water came forth, and the people drank. But what did God tell him to do this time? Speak to the rock. What did Moses do? He smote the rock the second time. We are told in Corinthians chapter 10 that these things, the children of Israel, their wanderings in the wilderness and all, these things all happened to them as examples unto us that we should not fall because of our own lust. And he tells us that that rock that was there in the wilderness was Jesus Christ. Now, Jesus often spoke of thirst and of water of life flowing freely to the thirsty soul. If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. And he that drinketh of the water that I give, out of his innermost being, there will flow rivers of living water. To the woman of Samaria said, drink of this water, but you're going to thirst again. But if you drink of the water that I give, you'll never thirst again. It'll be like a spring of living water just welling up within you. And in the last chapter of the book of Revelation, let him that heareth say, come. And let him that is athirst come and drink of the water of life freely. Jesus is the water of life. Water is essential for life. Your strongest drive is your air drive. Next to that is your thirst drive. And the body has to have moisture to survive. You can go without food for up to 40 days. You can't go more than 9 days without moisture, without water. You've got to have water to survive. Your body will dehydrate. And of course, out in the desert, will dehydrate in 2 days in the hot desert sun. That's why if you're ever lost in the desert, don't hike during the day. Try and get under a bush during the day and rest. Save your body moisture. And then walk at night, because that 7% humidity out there in the desert can just suck the moisture out of your body, and you can be dead within 24 hours just for the loss of moisture in your body. Now, if any of you ever survive in the desert because of that advice, I want you to come back and thank me. But I hope that none of you ever have that experience. So thirst, a common thing for man, but spiritual thirst is what Jesus was talking about. And that water of life that satisfies the thirsty spirit of man. And God was setting up a beautiful pattern in the wilderness. You see, before the rock could bring forth the water of life, it had to be smitten. So Jesus had to be smitten to bring forth the water of life to man. The cross was necessary. And there Christ was smitten, that he might bring forth life for each of us. But once smitten, He never needed to be smitten again. He died once and for all, so that all Moses had to do at this point was to speak to the rock, and the water would come flowing forth. And God was setting up a beautiful example for us here in the New Testament period to realize that the rock has been smitten, the water is flowing, it never needs to be smitten again. I am thirsty. What must I do to find the satisfaction? Just speak to the rock. Just ask and you shall receive. The rock has been smitten. Jesus was smitten for you. And the water of life can come flowing forth to you tonight by just asking, speaking to Him. Asking for Him to satisfy that clamant thirst within your life. And He will. It doesn't have to be smitten again. And so Moses, in smiting the rock the second time, destroyed the whole symbolism that God was creating there in the wilderness. The whole example was now wiped out. And thus it was a very serious thing that Moses did in his failure to represent God. Not only in representing God before the people, but to represent God in history. For he represented the rock as being smitten twice when not. That is not the case. The rock was smitten once, and that was sufficient. All a man has to do is speak to the rock. And so even for us today, we can't get the true symbolism by looking back, because Moses blew it in a fit of anger, upset. And how many times do we blow it just because we're upset, angry? And I do things that later I am sorry for. And I feel so miserable. How could I have done that? Oh, you know. And so with Moses, it was a tragic thing that he did, in that he destroyed the symbol that God was creating as an example. And he failed to represent God. Now, they are moving now towards the land. They need to pass through Edom. Edom was the descendants of Esau, the twin brother of Jacob. Of course, we know that there was bad blood between Jacob and Esau. And now in the descendants, 400 years later, actually 500 years after Jacob and Esau had had their tiff, Moses sends to the king of Edom and says, "Hey, we'd like to pass through your land. We'll stay right on the major highway, the king's highway. We won't venture into your fields. We won't pick your grain. We won't pick your crops. We won't even drink your water unless we pay for the water. But we want passage through your land so we can come to the land that God has promised. You know the problems we've had in Egypt. God's bringing us out and all." And the king of Edom came with his armies. They said, "Hey, you're not passing through here." Now, Edom will be taken care of by God in time to come, but at this point they just circumvent Edom. And we get then in verse 23 to the death of Aaron, as God said, "Take Aaron up to Mount Hor, take off his royal, you know, the priestly garments, put them on his son, because Aaron is going to die here. He can't go into the land because you rebelled against my word at the water of Meribah." Moses and Aaron's rebellion against the word of God there at the water. Now Aaron is disqualified and he dies there on Mount Hor. And Eleazar, his son, is appointed high priest in his place. So brings us up to one of the most interesting and fascinating stories in the Old Testament, this story of Balaam the prophet. And there are three references to this guy in the New Testament. I mean, he made an impression. And we'll get into that next week as we move on through Numbers in our next session. May the Lord bless you this week in a very special way. As you grow in His grace and the understanding of His love and the revelation of His will for your life. And may each of you seek God for what He would have you to do in serving Him. For as the congregation of God's people, we've all been called for service. We've not been all called to be ministers or pastors, but each of us have our place to fulfill in serving God in the functioning of a strong and healthy body. And God, help us this week that we might stand between the living and the dead, that we might see revival come to our community and to our nation as we pray and as we seek God's face. May it be a beautiful week. May you experience the presence of God's power in your life, the anointing of His Spirit upon you, as you become enriched in your walk and your relationship with Him through Jesus our Lord.